Today's speaker is David Ruff. David lives in Winona and works for the Nature Conservancy, where he leads strategies to expand forest-based climate solutions. Outside of work, he enjoys spending time outdoors, playing clarinet in the Winona Municipal Band, and chasing his two young children. David?
Well, hey, everyone. It's kind of fun to be up here. For those of you who don't know or simply have forgotten because it's been a while, so I grew up in Winona and actually came to this fellowship as a kid for a long time. So, and it's been fun to reconnect in the past couple. First-time caller, but it's fun to talk to you today. I'm also kind of excited to get to kick off the nature theme. So nature, I work for the Nature Conservancy, which is an environmental NGO. It's you know, where I've chosen to make my career. It's something I think a lot about, and I'm excited to get to think more about it in kind of a more spiritual sense with you all in the coming weeks. And thinking about what I wanted to talk about as our first speaker of the theme, I get to give a lot of presentations that are very sciencey, or kind of sciencey, at least, but don't necessarily sort of lead you to any deeper meditations that often. But another interest of mine that actually goes back to my environmental history major in undergrad is really just the way we think. The writer and thinker Raymond Williams, in his 1976 book, Keywords, said or wrote that nature is perhaps the most complex word in the language, the language being English. And it plays a significant role in society, and so I figured as we were about to think more about it, it might be fun to think about the different ways that different conceptions and definition of nature have shown up in the way we've thought about it within Western society, and how that's shaped environmentalism and the conservation movement that I'm part of today. So why is this such a complex word? Raymond Williams gives a few reasons. One is just it's sort of long term, like it gets very kind of gets into the history of it. And I also looked up the OED entry, and it's gigantic if you look at all these historical references. And partly that's because it plays a few different roles in language, right? Like the earliest one is actually to describe the inherent qualities of a thing. This is kind of what we mean when we talk about, you know, the way something naturally is, or your own, the elements of your nature. The OED would point out that it also, like, actually can refer to defecation in terms of answering nature's call. So there are all these funny ways, right, you know, nature's burden, that it shows up. But where it really gets complex and loaded within our culture is when we start thinking about it as more of a noun. What Raymond Williams calls embodied nature, or maybe just nature with a capital N. And this is often, I think, what we talk about when we talk about being out in nature. It's just the stuff that's all around us. And you look at definitions of that, and the main one from Oxford, at least, I didn't write it down, but it was something along the lines of the collective phenomena of the world and the cosmos, or something like that, which is actually not that far off from what Stan and Jan Berenstain wrote in the Berenstain Bears Nature Guide, which I quoted in my talk summary, right, which is, nature is every person, thing, and place here on Earth and out in space. It's all that is or was or ever will be, which is big. and, you know, if you think about this as a really significant word and the fact that it, I guess, essentially means everything, there's a bit of a puzzle there, because I tend to think that it's specificity that gives words power. So why is such a meaningful concept in our culture essentially defined as everything? I think the answer there kind of lies in the question that's hidden within it, which is, well, then fine, so what isn't nature? And generally, the couple answers to that are, well, it's either God or it's people, in a very simplistic sense. And you can see that in historical uses. And to me, the more interesting question there is what is the place of people within this? And that debate and discussion around how do we place people within our own conception of nature is pretty fundamental to how we think of our role with nature, what nature is and isn't. And it also gets into how does science fit and what role does science play for our understanding of what nature is. And there's a long history to that that actually goes back, I mean, to early days of the Enlightenment. You know, if you read Donald Wurster's book, Nature's Economy, he'll start you with Gilbert White and Carl Linnaeus in sort of thinking about a couple diverging paths of schools of thought for how people and science should relate to nature. That would be a very unfocused talk if I tried to give it. And so instead, I think I'm going to zero in to a place more kind of close to home in American history where the two different camps that Wurster points to were really in stark divide in the way the environmental movement was being shaped, our own sort of conceptions of nature and environmentalism. And that's back in the early 20th century. This is also when the topic of wilderness was coming up because America was had finally officially decided that we didn't have any more. Wilderness didn't show up on the census for the first time in the 1890 census, and there was a big thesis about that that could also be a subject of its own talk. And this is also the time when the field of ecology itself is starting to begin to be formalized into a full science and grow out of just the kind of more murky terrain of natural history or naturalism. And at this point, there's a kind of a stark divide that shows up in two really powerful figures within environmentalism and environmental history in America. And that's John Muir and Gifford Pinchot. And they both really encapsulate kind of the two different schools that Wurster finds in his book. Nature as this holistic body. And something that should be respected and in which people should attempt to approach humbly and find a humble coexistence within. And this tends to be the school of thought that a lot of the people we think of as kind of the great environmental writers in our culture are. You know, the transcendentalists certainly fit within this. John Muir is a great example. I would say Edward Abbey is a later extension of this in a lot of ways. And in Muir, this idea of this sort of reverence and respect for the larger holistic nature really takes shape in the way that he championed preservation as a form of protecting nature. And when he talked about it and when he thought about it, it's interesting that, you know, Muir was certainly a naturalist, but it's not what he really pushed in his writing. When he describes nature and describes the nature that he is trying to protect, you see really more of an aesthetic force. So he describes just the feeling of entering the Central Valley in Yosemite, and the power and the awe that the place can strike in you, and it really relates to the complex or the kind of the concept of the sublime, right? So these are places that inspire the sublime in people. It humbles them. It makes them think about God. It sort of amazes and inspires. And for Muir, this person that becomes important to protect, and that he really champions protecting and preserving in the creation of Yosemite National Park, the establishment of the National Park Service, all these things. And it contrasts really strongly with, instead, another really important figure in American environmental history, who is Gifford Pinchot. And he's someone who is probably less familiar than John Muir, but he is widely regarded as the father of American forestry. So, big deal to a forester like me. He actually learned forestry in Europe, which has a much longer track record of forestry as a scientific discipline, and then came back to America in kind of late 19th, early 20th centuries and founded the Yale School of Forestry, which is, depending on how you count it, either the oldest or second oldest forestry school in America. And then he worked with his good friend Teddy Roosevelt to get the resources. And he was the first director of the National Forest Service. And, you know, he was coming in at a time when the pattern of the 19th century had been this moving band of hotspots of find timber that we haven't found before, log it off, go like crazy, get wood, it's fine. It's a huge continent, we'll never run out, and then move on. And, you know, again, by the 1890 census, we're losing wilderness. We're starting to actually realize that there is an end to the continent. And so Pinchot starts really talking about the importance of thinking more carefully and using it. Talks about managing forests in order to ensure the greatest good for the greatest number now and in the future. So one thing I find interesting is this is essentially the idea of sustainability before sustainability is a word, right? Using resources in a way where you don't diminish the capacity of future generations to enjoy them is at least one definition of sustainability. It's totally different from the idea of, you know, nature as this incredible, holy thing to be revered and just treasured for its incredible need to live and survive and raise our quality of life. And we should use science and manage it better so that we can make sure that as we use it, we don't make it so that there isn't any left for the people who come after us. Those two camps are really, it's a great example of the two different, what Worster calls the Acadian and the Imperial schools of environmental thought. And they also really set up a lot of kind of the larger trajectory of conservation and nature protection that carries on into the 20th century. I'll take a little bit of time and just sort of unpack them, because what I think is interesting is I still wrestle with the fact that we have really two powerful sort of guiding philosophies about why it's important to protect nature and use nature wisely that motivate people and resonate with people within America culturally. And both of them rely on a very different, just definitional place for people within the concept of nature, right? And they also have some just deep fundamental flaws that make it difficult to sort of, you know, as someone who wants to be sort of pushing like the best, most recent sort of best attitude towards nature as I can and how we approach it scientifically and managerially, make it tough then when trying to also sell these ideas to the public and donors, which I do occasionally in my work. Maybe starting with Pinchot, where I think some of the flaws are obvious, right? He's talking about getting the most good for the greatest number, this idea of wise use. And first of all, there's just an inherent commodification in that, right? That this is something that gives us stuff. Now the common terminology is, this is a crime I commit in my work. I am involved in projects attempting to develop carbon projects to help fund improved forest management, which is a direct measurement and then commodification and then selling of this commodity of just the products of photosynthesis, which is carbon sequestration, which can have an important role within the larger socio-political system that we sit in, but doesn't leave a lot of room for reverence. And also that it also implies a certain attempt at maximizing. And I had a professor once, when talking about, you know, sort of planning philosophies, point out that mathematically you can do equations to maximize individual benefits given a set of constraints. But it's not mathematically possible to maximize multiple things at once. And so, just from a scientific perspective, if we start thinking that our job is to maximize and ignore the fact that this means we're going to need to be making trade-offs inherently, it can lead to some pretty poor choices, especially when it's done in ways that ignore some of the interdependencies in the system that's already there if we look at it more holistically. So some classic examples, I would say fire suppression is one, right? Trying to keep the forest that we want to have for our stuff from burning up led to Gifford Pinchot and the 10 o'clock rule, that any fire observed in a forest should be put out by 10 o'clock that morning. That gradually got harder and harder to follow through on. The philosophy of predator removal for game management, right? We can get more game if we just take out all the other competition and the predators, which had devastating ecological consequences that ended up inspiring another pretty important writer who I might mention later. And even just, you know, timber management focused on maximizing production of just timber ignores so much else that goes on in a forest and ecology. And so it's kind of a consumptive mindset that also, when you start understanding trade-offs, really can steer you, if you're not careful, in some problematic directions ecologically. At the same time, when we think about that Acadian school and that just what turns into, partly through the influence of Muir, the broader preservation movement, right? Now we're talking about nature as something that is really almost a sacred thing that just needs to be special places. Lock them down, right? Keep people out. This influences the wilderness movement. This has some pretty big issues as well, not the least of which is that it's just incredibly naive, and naive in a really racist way, because it's based on totally ignoring the fact that every place on this continent for years was managed by indigenous people until we kicked them off. And then decided that the state of nature, once the indigenous caretakers were removed, was now the inherent natural quality of that place that we should protect for all time, but also keep people off of it. That doesn't add up. And it also had big consequences. I mean, partly it's you can see in this the desire to get natural resources was a strong motivation for our horrible policies towards American Indians. And then where we didn't have those things, all of a sudden we discovered that it was beautiful. And then we're like, well, we can't have American Indians here either. And so then we pushed them out because now we just wanted a place untrammeled by human beings. And it also is ecologically faulty because it ignores the really beneficial role that human management can play and forgets that if we do just leave these places alone, if we're just disconnecting them, right? Like nature doesn't exist in these sort of little pockets. It's this broader interconnected thing. And then also, if we're not going in and providing the management, we actually see forces take over that simplify and we lose biodiversity and ecosystems get less healthy, right? This is another reason we did fire suppression. So, you know, two giant oopsies that we made in our history have in common that, like, they both can find a rationale in each sort of depression. Take human use out of the equation in these places, and now we're simply protecting nature for its, you know, reverent, sublime qualities. It kind of takes some of the motivation for understanding them scientifically away, too. The one thing about the commodification is that if we agree we should be commodifying and dealing with the sort of the products of nature responsibly, that's really strong motivation for researching it and understanding the impacts. And now if we say that actually, no, really what matters is that we just don't touch these places, it removes a lot of the inspiration for understanding kind of the consequences of our actions in them, because we're just saying we're gonna step back. And so there's actually sort of almost a denigration of science and the role of understanding nature that comes when you simply declare it as a sacred space. I think there's just a really interesting thing there that I haven't unpacked yet around this as almost a model for how holding something up as sacred takes away a desire to investigate it, right? And kind of parallels some of the tensions between science and the church historically, right? What's the right way to scientifically investigate the knowable questions about something while still revering it and respecting in a kind of sacred way the aspects of it that are based in unanswerable questions? And how do you sort of still find motivation to nibble at the knowable while respecting the unknowable. Is it a tension that has a long history in the church and also a long history in ecology? And we're still not, I don't think we found a good way to unpack it in ecology yet. This is sort of a side note, but it's that sort of anti-science strain within environmentalism shows up in interesting ways in some modern debates. And things where you would sort of, on first blush, think that some political camps might be odd bedfellows, right? I think of vaccine skepticism and the popularity with technology stepping in and sort of, you know, tweaking something in a way that can be viewed as not entirely natural. And so there's a potentially a resonance with the skepticism of that. I think you can find a similar thing with GMOs, right? That's not to say that there aren't valid concerns with the specific uses of specific, the individual use cases, and it turns more into an argument about whether or not that's an appropriate use of science. I'm really interested to see as lab-grown meat becomes more of a thing, how do different camps form up around whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. So we're left with this legacy of kind of the two culturally dominant motivations for working with and protecting and trying to interact with nature that, I think you've got the really appropriate reverence and holding nature in awe and just understanding it as this sort of large, in some ways truly unknowable thing. And then you've got the sort of more practical, let's understand this and figure out how it benefits, relate. And again, I see one of the biggest tensions being simply in being unsure how to incorporate people into the definition of nature. And I'll just spoiler alert. I'm not gonna really come up with a good answer for this. So I think that's gonna be an unsatisfying wrap up when I finish. Partly because it's just complicated, and partly because I don't know, I guess I like questions more than answers, and I sort of get bored when actually something has an answer. So that's going to show up here. But I will say that, future thinkers have found better ways, I think, to talk about our place that at least have really resonated with me. And I think you're seeing the power of a better starting point for humans' relationship with nature in environmental thought in the growing popularity of writers like Aldo Leopold, and then also the current popularity around benefits, I think, from not being as purely developed in the Western mindset, although certainly she's familiar with it as well. Leopold, I think, is cool because he is totally a product of Western science, and he, just by being a really thoughtful, careful observer, ended up discovering some of these faults and issues with a lot of conservation. And by paying attention to the reverence that he had for the system, came around to a place that actually has a lot of similarities to some of the other indigenous traditions that we hear about, right? You think about, and this is kind of where I would sort of leave us is, Leopold belonging to us. And when we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. Which I think is something you absolutely find in the ideas of reciprocity that Kimmerer proposes as well and champions. And this idea of maybe shifting the definition of nature from this, web, which is fairly static, right? That just means things are connected. But instead starting to think of it as a community. What's different there is it still gives us agency. It starts to provide us a way of thinking about they're both sources of benefit and obligation. And that I think that obligation starts to get at the respect and reverence for the broader community without negating the sort of real need to still benefit from nature. I will also say, if you look at our seventh principle, thinking about definitions, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, places us solidly in the Acadian camp as Unitarian Universalists. And so I think in that respect, that's, if we're just part of that web, thinking of it in that way, where we have both legitimate agency to act and then also obligations to the maintenance of the whole, can be really helpful. So TLDR, Muir and Pinchot, okay. Leopold and Kimmerer, woohoo. And with that, I guess I'll stop there and leave some time for questions.
Thank you. I can remember when clean air and clean water and stopping pollution was like generally accepted across the political spectrum. It's something that everybody was for. But now it seems that environmentalism, nature has just become, unfortunately, categorized as just another special interest, much like Big Pharma and Army. Can we go back to this idea that protecting nature, clean water and clean air is good for everyone, and it's not something that has to be subjugated to, say, other economic interests and such? And I know I saw the deep ecology movement in the 90s and earlier is trying to do that, and that was attacked by the government, attacked by capitalists, et cetera. But what can we do in the environment, people off land or fighting to preserve privileged states? Thank you.
Yeah, so this gets tricky because I think that there, you have the short-term tactical solutions and then the deep socio-cultural structural frameworks that shape the possible political solutions. I think I generally agree with people who talk about sort of the consensus around the importance of clean air and clean water being victims of their own success, right? And this is coming directly out of the way we commodify those ecosystem services, right? The ability to breathe the air, when it's viewed as a sort of a good, a public good, is something that it's easy to sort of take for granted once it's just there and you're not really paying attention to it. And so if the motivation and the way we justify defending it really relies on pointing out to people that, oh, well, actually breathing clean air is an economic benefit that you're gaining, and the price is the cost of regulation. When people aren't facing the consequences of losing it, it loses its power. And on the other hand, if we get to the point where broader, culturally, we shift the way we think about our whole relationship with nature to being more one that does involve kind of thinking about it as a comparative towards this, and it's less of a economic question, more of a moral question. And that is that's a shift that's not gonna happen. Like, that's a long-term cultural project that would then take a long time for the political results of it to actually show up, but would be more durable. And the issue is then, you have to use one sort of cultural tradition of respecting nature in terms of that commodification piece to justify the really quick need to defend these things, and do so while also trying to cut away at that commodification. It's hard.